Hello, my name is Michael, and you're listening to Forever Sound Version, a video game music podcast. This is episode 28, and it's one I've been looking forward to for a little while now, as I'm joined by Rob and Purnell from the Rhythm and Pixels video game music podcast, which is my favourite podcast at this point. If you're not already a listener, I recommend that you check out their show with every fibre of my being. Needless to say, I was very excited and maybe a little nervous too to tackle this one, since those fellas were very kind to take the time out to join me in addressing game music from old school 8-bit and 16-bit home systems like the Commodore 64, Amiga, the Atari 8-bit family, and the Atari ST. A quick note before we get started. One of my picks for this show is from a 1994 game from out of the Czech Republic called Gunhead for the Atari 8-bit family. This is not to be confused with the excellent PC Engine shooter of the same name, which we in the West know better as Blazing Lasers. I didn't know about this alternate title before recording, but, you know, you learn something new every day. To open the show, here's a track from a game by Codemasters called Twin Turbo V8 for the ZX Spectrum, a driving game in which you take the wheel of what appears to be a red Ferrari. It's pretty basic, but it does boast a ripper of a ZX Spectrum beeper tune. Here it is, the title theme from Twin Turbo V8, composed by Lyndon Sharp. Howdy, dear friends, and welcome to episode number 28 of Forever Sound Version. My name is Michael, and today I have the distinction of being joined by two tremendous podcast guests. We have Rob and Purnell from Rhythm and Pixels. How are you doing, fellas?
Hey, thanks for having us on the show.
Looking forward to it, rather, have been looking forward to it.
No doubt. Me too. So, for listeners who have been checking out my show and Rhythm and Pixels in the past, you'll know that I appeared on their show back in February, was it? It was some months ago, right?
Yeah, it was a while back, and the topic we did was... I don't recall anymore.
That was the topic. That was the actual topic. Right?
It was a while ago, yeah, and we've been wanting to do this again because I've been a huge fan of your show. I love the format. I love your insight and your background and history with the tracks. It's really great, and your music battles are just hilarious and
oh,
fun.
Oh man, really, thank you very much.
You really feel like you're part of like that group and just drinking with them, and it doesn't like evolve. It doesn't devolve into like, you know, like total nonsense anyway.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of editing goes into these shows, you know, so
oh yeah
it's always a challenge to cut the nonsense,
and we know all about that sort of.
And I genuinely just the fact that you tend to come from an area of games that I usually don't visit, which both gives me awesome insight onto tracks from games I would not have noticed otherwise, like that 170s drive track. To this day I listen to it on a regular.
Oh man.
And then aside from that, it's also just every once in the blue moon, you might even come up with a game from like that didn't even come out here. Like, I might just like it might play it out over there. I'm like, hey, that you know that existed, but now I got to at least find the soundtrack for it and give it a more in depth inspection.
Yeah.
So
that works both ways, though. I mean, you've dropped plenty of tracks from games that I didn't even realize existed. So it's cool that we have this thing going on back and forth where we can share tunes with each other. You know, it's good.
Yeah, yeah. I really like exploring and doing research on the music that I or from the games I really don't know anything about. So that was today in spades.
Totally. Well, let's get into this, shall we? This is this is kind of a bit of a cheeky one on my part because I wanna see just how deep your crates go. Like, I already knew they go pretty deep, but we're gonna test the depth on this one, I think. And I've been testing myself to the same end. This is a show about what I consider to be the old school, or at least my conception of the old school in VGM. So, old school's always going to mean different things to different people, but to myself, as someone who grew up in early 90s England, it means a time when there didn't seem to be too much of a distinction between games you played on early games consoles and games you played on, like, what you would call home computers, you know? Like, it was all just games, and for a lot of us, our experiences depended on the hardware we were able to get our hands on, cheaply or free from family members or whatever. And I was lucky in that regard because my granddad used to run a small independent video rental shop that used to stock bits and pieces of game stuff. So the first game I ever played was a port of Donkey Kong on the ColecoVision, right?
Oh, wow. Sweet.
So my parents have like this grainy old camcorder video of me playing on it somewhere. So I'm like 4 years old and getting excited with this weird numeric keypad thing, you know?
Oh, the Coleco controller is so strange, yeah.
And Donkey Kong on the Coleco is... That game on the Coleco is freaking brutal, too. It is not easy.
Are you telling me?
Mm-hmm.
So, when I was thinking of old school, I was thinking, like, for us in the States, mainly, like, computer systems pre-Nintendo, or pre, big boom Nintendo. But I don't know, like when games were released here, like what kind of, if there was a delay before they were released to the UK, because there was like a lot of them were still coming from Japan.
Right.
But
right.
I know a lot of our releases for the NES were from Rare, like RC Pro-Am and all those early games. And those were all like UK developed, right?
Rare's a UK team, yeah. Come from a long lineage of UK-based companies that started out like super small and ended up, like some of them fell by the wayside, but others, through various mergers and what have you, would continue to do the rounds to this day, you know? And a lot of these companies, I guess, we're going to see represented in the picks we have today, especially for, say, the Commodore 64 and Amiga kind of titles. You know, I got a Commodore 64 through my granddad again, and from then on I was completely hooked on games, right? Like, I got a chunky Game Boy after that, which I still own and love very much.
Awesome, yeah.
And it was around the time I'd go over to friends' houses, play on machines like the NES and the Amiga after school on weekends. So, you know, that was my old school, like, you know, basically sharing whatever hardware you had. That's until the golden age, the beautiful golden age of affordable 16-bit consoles arrived, right? And then on, it was just, Nintendo or Sega from then. So, again, this episode's kind of a bit of a challenge to myself, but also just to the three of us as a team, I like to think, to see what we can come out with within my very nebulous idea of old school. So it's quite a broad theme, really, but hopefully the idea will shine through with our picks. We'll see what happens, shall we?
Cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
I think my issue with this challenge of yours was the fact that, well, two things. One, like you were mentioning, you grew up, you were playing the NES and the Amiga, you know, in the 90s. But over here, the way it ended up playing, I was like, we had Amiga and we had Coleco and whatnot. But the moment NES became, it released in 85. But once when it became really big, which was around like 87 or so, everything else aside pretty much dropped off the map. Like, you wouldn't go to anyone's house and see anything but NES. You might have the one Rare friend that had a Sega Master System and people pointed at him, but for the most part, it was NES for days. So
it truly was. Like, someone who had a Master System, it was like weird.
It really was.
It was weird to see that.
And then, like, I did play some of those older machines, but the problem was the majority of the games I played on those, like Smurf and Pole Position, none of them had music that I'd even consider remotely memorable, if music at all. It was usually blip, blip, like just sounds.
Right.
So you forced me to dig real deep and figure out just what existed on these consoles, to which I was glad to realize that a lot of these games, as he was getting released in the 90s for these computer systems, which kept me from having to rely on the Nintendo as being
cool,
my old school pick.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to dig in something like unfamiliar territory, and I've seen your three picks, and for what it's worth, I think they're all blinders, and luckily for me, I was already kind of familiar with them from those days, you know. So yeah, this is going to be fun, and I know Rob has some real bangers too. How do you want to do this? How about one of you kick us off with a pick?
All right, not it.
No, so thanks, Rob. Thanks for nothing.
Let's go for now. What do you have for us?
Do it. Represent the team.
Okay, well, the first thing I'm going to pick is a track that I'm genuinely familiar with. So familiar that a version of this track is actually my cell phone ringtone at present. So I was glad to see that I could choose it for this episode. And that track is the level 2 BGM from the game Pac-Mania. The stage itself is referred to as Pac-Man Park.
Pac-Man Park.
And on the Amiga. So.
All right, let's go. Level 2 BGM from Pac-Mania on the Amiga, composed by Ben Daglish, I believe. Talk us through that one, Pernell.
Well, one thing out of the blue is that I didn't want to get cheap on this because I could have easily just made this episode ease tracks from old systems, because right. That would have been a cakewalk for me. But
that we have our own show for that.
This is true. But this track in particular, I like taking tracks from games that I am familiar with on other systems, typically sometimes newer systems, and then hearing how they sound on the computer hardware or older hardware, because it can go one of two ways. Either they'll take the same track, but you know, just make concessions based on what the hardware is that they're using here, or they'll just go in a completely different direction and make a brand new track just for that console. And of course, that's usually the biggest surprise for me. But in this case, they went with the same track, but they made concessions. And I honestly do enjoy this track about as much as the Genesis version, which is the one I'm most familiar with.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
And it goes well with the game itself. It's a very frenetic game. As you might know from basic Pac-Man, you're dealing with 4 to 5 ghosts at most. But in Pac-Mania, you can be dealing with up to 10 to 12 ghosts.
Is this the one that's like isometric?
Yeah, it's isometric, right? 3D. Right. Sometimes there's multiple. It's more like it might be like 2 to 6 tunnels. Pac-Man can jump. It's a really odd game.
More like a bounce, right? He doesn't have any legs still.
Yeah, he has no legs.
How
just kind of sprints.
It's amazing.
Maybe pull like a freaking like a One Piece sort of style where he just kind of squishes down and then boings up. I don't know. But he gets to moving on those ghosties. And I love that game for that. It's probably the most frenetic Pac-Man game I know of alongside Pac-Man Championship, not your Pac-Man Anniversary Edition. So that's why
it's
I always
great
enjoy
game,
coming
man.
Back to
I mean,
this.
This is something that really takes me back because I don't know how familiar you are with the Acorn Archimedes computer. Is that a name?
That
to
is so alien to us. Yeah.
I've heard of it now. Thanks.
You could make all this up and we'll never know.
Okay. So the Acorn Archimedes was a computer that was like a, it was like a machine that did the rounds over here in the UK. It's like a computer for schools. So this is kind of a PC before Windows standardization got into schools.
Okay.
So we, in my secondary school, so I'm talking like between the years 11 and like 16, the first couple of years, we didn't have any computers with like Windows on them. So we had these like Acorn Archimedes machines, and the only game we were allowed to have on was Pac-Mania. So this tune's been completely etched into my brain, like
that's
never to be
awesome.
Erased, you know?
See, for us, our schools were riddled with Apple IIe's.
Yeah. Ooh. Growing up, we had Apple IIe's like in like every classroom. And growing up, we had one at home with like, you know, the green color on the dark screen. And so I used to bring in like discs of like pinball and the oh my god, I can't think of the name anymore. You know, you died of dysentery.
Yeah, we had Oregon Trail.
Oregon
which
Trail.
Is that game.
Oh my god.
And we also was big with Number Munchers.
Number Munchers. Oh man, I look for that still. I can't find it.
I had a guy actually legitimately try to trash talk Number Munchers recently, and I had to put him in his place. Like, look here, just because the game was educational doesn't mean it's not fun.
Oh, I thought he was trash talk like he's better at you.
No, he was talking about how terrible it was. Like, man, you guys were really deprived of actual fun games if you were hooked on Number Munchers. Like, maybe if there was a Number Munchers on the PlayStation 4, you could learn something.
Yeah,
I would
go
nuts for that.
I'm waiting for the Number Munchers esports competitive scene to emerge over there on the East Coast.
Oh, that would be bliss.
Number Munchers speedrunner.
This guy's got his calculator. He's doing the equations in advance. It's so good.
Yeah, well, that's a great pick, Vanille. Thanks for that. That's do you know the C64 version of that tune? Because that one's, I mean, the C64 version of that game, rather. Because it plays surprisingly well.
Honestly, I've never played it, but now I kind of want to. Like, I'm hoping that there may be some sort of Commodore 64 emulation out there.
Oh yeah,
to give a try because I might look at
that.
Very
easy.
The Commodore 64.
Yeah.
How many could it display more than like one or two colors at a time?
The C64.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you how many at once, but it's it does okay.
Okay. I might be thinking of another machine, but I'm seeing in my mind games that are like all pink. Or like pink with like blue at the bottom or something. Maybe that's the ZX or ZX Spectrum.
One of those, yeah. C64, man. It's I suppose I'm always going to talk it up because I'm a bit of a C64 fanboy to the point where I'm actually wearing a Commodore 64 T-shirt right now.
Oh, that's awesome!
Oh, that's slick.
I love that.
So yeah,
makes me feel good about my picks. Then I was playing to the judge here. Yay!
Well, I love the sound chip of the C64. The SID chip is awesome. I love that it's because it's got the filters on it. Like you get a sound out of that you don't get out of like the PSG or anything else.
Yeah, exactly. It's magic. So shall we move on to your pick, Rob?
Sure. I'm going to start with the title theme to the game Synapse or Synapse.
Synapse. I have no idea how to pronounce this, but let's go Synapse. I like that.
Yeah. So this is for the Atari ST, composed by Dave Rogers.
All right. Thank you. some pretty wild stuff there from Dave Rogers. That was the title theme from Zynapse on the Atari ST, and that one really took us on a bit of a trip, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I love how like rhythmic that whole track is. And even like the melody sections, the sound chip's got like an arpeggiation effect going on,
right,
with
right.
that lead sound. But it's so fast. There's so much going on. I think the ST chip is obviously 8-bit, but it only had like 3 waveforms and a sound and a noise generator. For them to do all that with just the 3 waveforms is really cool. Really, really cool.
That's part of the craft for sure. Yeah, it's getting a little, getting a lot out of a little, so to speak.
Yeah.
And there's just so much in the way of like interesting harmonizing going on that piece. And yeah, as well really as was. The bass, like the bass gets really heavy at points.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me when you get like really good bass out of these old 8-bit systems, because they couldn't generate, you know, sine waves, so they can get really low on the square wave or really low on like, or like how the NES would do with a triangle wave. So when you got really low, like on a square wave or on the C64 SID chip, they would use like a low pass like cutoff filter, which they were able to do, and so you were able to get those really low deep sounds. And so when it's successful, it's like it makes you go, oh, this machine can do what now? it's crazy.
Pretty rich on the bottom end.
Totally.
Yeah. Great stuff, man. What do you think, Pinnell?
I thought the track sounded really good. And
you were
the
popping over there.
I was doing my hop bop, but I had to figure out what this game was all about. And that's something I have a penchant for doing on the show regular, too, because Rob likes to go out of left field with some of his stuff. And when he does, I'm like, this sounds so good, but I got to know where is it used?
Yeah, I know it's a shooter. It's like a side scroller.
Yeah, the ship kind of resembles a Galaga ship going horizontally. And it sort of seems like it has like an R-type sort of play style to it.
That's exactly what I thought as well. It looks a lot like R-type to my eyes.
It seemed pretty cool, and this music would go pretty well with it, though. And the quick bit of research I did, one thing that surprised me about it, I'm not sure how 100% true this is, but apparently the game doesn't end. It just loops.
Nice.
So like you get to the end, it's like, nah, you can go out to stage 1 now and just keep shooting things.
It's my kind of game. Just doesn't end. It just gets harder and harder.
It's beautiful. Yeah, this is a game published by a company called Houston, who do have some pedigree in terms of like 8-bit home computers and 16-bit home computers also. It published a lot of C64 classics like Nebulous, which is a kind of a platform where you go around a tower and the tower kind of moves. It's like a sort of a cylindrical tower, and your kind of character hops from platform to platform.
Oh, like that Dynamite Heady stage.
Or like a stage in Battletoads towards the end where you're going up the tower.
Yeah, I think Nebulous was kind of a pioneer of that sort of mechanic. And there's another game Houston published called Paradroid. Are you familiar with Paradroid?
No, but I kind of want to be now. It's like parachuting robot.
Sure sounds like it, right?
I would venture it's even more far-fetched than that. Like, it's a game where you're a droid on this ship, and you have you don't have much of an offensive ability, but you have the ability to kind of hack into other droids who are more powerful, and then you take on their form, and you have to go around the ship and eradicate all the other droids just by your strange digital powers of manipulation. it's a really wild game, and it's considered one of the best on the C64. So,
oh, cool.
Do you happen to have Xbox? Like the later Xbox One or PS4, because if you do, look into a game called Headlander. It was done by Adult Swim Games.
Oh yeah,
you wouldn't think it, but they actually put out some pretty decent product. And Headlander has a similar idea where you're a disembodied head with thrusters, and you can fly around and attach yourself to other machines on the ship, and you can control them and use their abilities while you're running around.
That sounds like Paradroid. Yeah, similar sort of thing.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's nice stuff. Dave Rogers, I don't know a whole lot about Dave Rogers, but he does have quite a few credits. And from what I can tell, this is the earliest credit I could find for him for his compositional work. Other works he's done include music for Turbo Boat Simulator, which sounds like an absolute blast, by the way. Cybernoid and Universal Soldier on the Game Boy. So
guy's
got some credits.
I'm going to have to look that one up then, because I could see this style translating really well to the Game Boy.
Mm.
And often a lot of those like movie, especially R-rated movie tie-in tracks to like the Game Boy or NES have awesome soundtracks.
Right, right. No doubt. So I believe it's my turn. So I'm going to throw I'm going to throw some Commodore 64 at you right out of the gate.
Do it.
And this is a curious one because it's a game that was published in 2013, very recently. So there's still a couple of companies who make new software for the Commodore 64. And at this point, you know, people who are invested in the hardware have some serious chops with programming and design. So these games are oftentimes really, really good. I'm going to be playing a track from one such game published by Cytronic Software, and the game is called The Vice Squad, and this is the title track. Had the title tune from The Vice Squad on the Commodore 64, composed by Linus, also known as Sascha Ziedler. And I'm a big fan of this style of chiptune composition. And actually, I don't know about what you fellas think, but it's got a sort of Streets of Rage 3 kind of feel to it, in a way, do you reckon?
Yeah, totally. Like the way the lead synth is kind of like going, and that bass. It's like all like
growling, right?
I don't know. Yeah, it's like a growling, really good filtered sound, but it's just driving through the whole track. But it's real fast. I love that tune so much, and that's newer. It's a newer game,
very new.
Like a demo scene style.
Yeah. So the game itself, I've actually got a little blurb here from the promotional materials about the story behind it. And it's pretty daft. So El Guato, a Mexican drug baron, is expanding his empire to your city. He is ruthless and dangerous and must be stopped at all costs. You are Captain James Hutch. You've never dealt with a villain this powerful before, but that won't stop you from bringing his empire to its knees. I mean, how could you not get into this game on the back of that?
That's awesome.
And I'm looking at it. It heavily resembles Spy Hunter, but horizontal scrolling instead of vertical.
Oh, cool.
And when you really think about it, I can't recall the last time I played a game that even remotely resembled Spy Hunter. So this carries a decent niche to it, too.
Right, bringing that style back.
Like you want to play. Yeah, I would totally play this game.
And with soundtrack like that, though, that is insane. Do you think that that style of tune and maybe the complexity of that is because maybe it's not on the classic hardware and he has the disk space to work with?
I'm not entirely sure about that because I've got this game running on my actual C64.
Oh, okay.
They publish like tapes, tapes and discs for these games, and it's still just like a single SID chip, 3-channel chip tune. Like it sounds like really dense, like there's far too much going on for it to work in the capacity of C64's memory, but no, it's for real. That's no frills. That's a C64 chip tune through and through. So hats off. Cytronic Software, if you're into this tune and you're into and reinterpretations of old games but on C64, then I would encourage any listener to have a look and see what they're doing. I think one of them, I was just saying to Pernell before, I believe one of them might live around my way in Newcastle. Maybe one day I'll meet him and beg him to finish the Metroid game they've been working on for a couple of years.
Just got to carry around like a box, a box print, and just kind of hang it from your arm so that you're always clearly a fan. And he'll just spot you and she's like, oh my God, he's wearing my game. And then boom, you made the connection.
Yeah.
You have like the game in your back pocket and you see him. Can you sign my game? I've been carrying it with me every day for the last 4 years.
I've been waiting for you to notice me.
Yeah. No, that doesn't sound crazy at all.
No, it's enthusiastic.
Well, you know, it's odd you mention it like that because, I mean, talking about like old school games and that era, in some ways the developers of the time were treated like rock stars. You know, the coverage they would get in magazines and signing copies of games, I mean, all that actually happened, and it made famous people out of school kids, right? Like there's quite a few examples of kids who were just like if it weren't for games they would have been working in a steel mill or something, but they were like it's wild. That's how it was. Yeah.
Was a thought I had since we're on the topic of like famous people in the games. Have you noticed that it seems like in this day and age now, the fame, I mean, outside of the studio name, like you can be like, hey, Rare did a game, or you know, just random studio, Nipponichi Software. But as far as individuals go, it pretty much stems to the composers now. Like even not thinking outside of our podcast, like you go to like conventions and stuff, the guests are usually music composers. It's rarely, hey, this is a head developer for this game. Have him sign your product. It's usually the musicians.
Right.
And I think that's a very interesting change-up in how games are being acknowledged. It's more about who's making the music than who's making the games themselves.
Well, in the game, I feel like the music is such an important part. Even in modern games, it's so important. And that music becomes the voice of the game. And often, even if there's multiple musicians, it's usually one main composer or two or three main composers. And so it's their voice is the voice of the game, even though the game might have been developed by a team of like 50. It still like comes down to, you know, one dude or one group of people just doing it.
One composer, one console.
Against the
no
odds.
No mercy.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I suppose, I mean, for myself, Final Fantasy kind of is Nobuo Uematsu and vice versa.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Earlier today, I was just playing a bunch of the, the Distant Worlds and the Black Mages albums. And maybe we're a little biased because we obviously care a lot about video game music. But even before I was really digging particularly deep into this stuff, like it's in my mind's eye, like, yeah, that's what Final Fantasy is. Like, it's the music. They're one and the same.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Even before I knew who Nobuo Uematsu was, I was all about the music. Like, who wrote this stuff? This stuff is genius. I need more of it. And then when you would hear about a new game coming out, you looked forward to more of the music that you would hear. Like, I can't wait for that boss battle because I got to hear what the music sounds like. And if it was lacking, you'd feel so let down. Like, oh, man, I don't feel tense at all. This is just a glove slap battle. This is nothing.
Well, how did you feel about the music from Persona 5? I know that was the most recent one you really would put a lot of time into. Like put up against the rest of the Persona series that you've played. How did you feel about it?
Well, that was an interesting one, actually, because I may have mentioned this earlier on our show, but I'm not all that big on hearing music from a game before I've played the game, because I feel like the game puts a lot of the weight on what you're hearing. And I heard the boss battle music from Persona 5 before I played the game. I was like, this music's terrible. I hate this track. I'm not a fan. And I went into the game with this perception of I hate the boss theme for Persona 5. Really? I'd much rather had 4's.
Ooh, okay.
And I get to the first boss battle, and it starts to play up as the battle kicks in, because it starts up during a cinematic, and the guy becomes the first big monster. I was like, holy crap, what's going on? And the music pulsates, and it's called Blooming Villain. So with that name and the sound and that first scene that takes place when the music's playing, it's a guy who realizes that he's more powerful than you want to believe. And he's like, starts to grow. He's like, you can't beat me. I can do anything I want. And you're like, oh crap, this guy is, he's on fire. And it's like, then the battle kicks in and the notes hit just right. And now I love the music. I love the boss theme in the game. I listen to it at work all the time. So the gameplay itself, along with the music, comes together to form a complete package that makes it so much easier to appreciate.
Right. That's a similar... John, on our battle episode the other week, made a very similar point about just the regular battle music on Persona 5 and how this... Mm-hmm. Every now and then, if you complete a battle in a certain manner and, if you time it right, then you get this kind of serendipitous coincidence between the... You never see us coming line in the lyrics, and then
you'll never see it coming.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the guy gets nuts, like you didn't see it coming.
So yeah, maybe actually playing the game does inspire you to have some like nuanced appreciation of the music. So you can, I do listen to this stuff in isolation a whole lot. I mean, there are soundtracks I love that I haven't even played the game, but
this
gives you more incentive to check out the game itself, and then I don't doubt that I'll have a bit more appreciation for the music on the strength of it.
Mm-hmm. Like, we've had that here before, too. Like, Rob picks from a game, like, regularly. It's called, like... It's a Japanese RPG. It's like Madara Senki Madara or something.
Morio Senki Madara.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. And I've never played it, but I love the music, and it makes me want to go play the game and find the context for it. So it definitely can work both ways. It's just a matter of how do you end up coming into it. And that leads me to like a random point, but I should probably save it to the next segment. Yeah, otherwise, we'll be talking forever.
We're just going on. We're going on. This is your show.
Don't worry about that. Well, anyway, yeah. Since you mentioned it, let's get onto that next track, and I believe it's Purnell's again.
Oh yeah, the track I'm going to choose is from a game that has a surprising history. It's called The Great Gianna Sisters.
Oh yeah.
And the track title is Loader, and this is also on the Commodore 64. I believe the composer's name is Chris Hulsbeck.
Chris Hulsbeck, the legend. Yeah, that's him. Chris Eelsbeck, load of music from Great Gianna Sisters. And, you know, I'm a big fan of C64 loader music in general. You know, something nice to bump as you wait for the game to load from tape, if it loads. And, yeah, so that one's no exception. That's a really nice example. Well, Rob, why don't you pick this track for now?
Fun history about this game, actually. So, The Great Gianna Sisters is a game that came out in about 87 or 88 or so. And it was developed by the studio. Chris Hulsbeck did the music for that. And it developed a really bad reputation as being a complete knockoff of the Super Mario Brothers.
Which it is, in all fairness, but okay.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, I'm not going to sit there and say it's wrong, you know. But I guess in recent years, like, say the last, say, 7 or 8 years, a studio called Black Forest Games decided that they wanted to take another crack at Gianna Sisters and give it a more respectable release, because there was a DS release in there too somewhere, but it was just more of the same, just on the DS.
Okay.
So they got Chris back on music, and fun fact, actually, the trademark for Great Gianna Sisters Twisted Dreams, which is the name of the game that came out, and Black Forest Games was held by the old law firm I used to work for.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's
crazy.
I was going through the records like, hey, I know this name, because wow. I was the record clerk. I was the record keeper, so I was like, oh, I know that name. I love that game series. So that's why I kind of came across this game. I was like, wait a minute, I could look and see if this game has any tracks that would be awesome for this episode. And sure enough,
there it is.
And the game Twisted Dreams, which came out in 2013, also has great music, because Chris went and did the music for that. And they also got a metal band called Machine Supremacy to do music for it as well. And it's a legitimately awesome OST. Like, it's totally worth it. Even if you don't play the game itself, that music is legit.
Well, that name is super metal.
Oh, yeah, man.
It's what? Serious stuff. Yeah, I mean, really, really curious title, this one. As you say, blatant ripoff of Super Mario Brothers, but it was kind of the Super Mario Brothers if you didn't have an NES. In fact, I've been, you know, reading into this title on the old Lemon 64 message boards and things online, C64 fans, and a lot of people said we weren't actually really aware of what Super Mario Brothers was. We just had the Great Gianna Sisters and thought that's what the game was, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but it's actually a pretty good ripoff. A ripoff, but a good one. It's fairly intuitive on the old joystick, and to be honest, it's not quite Super Mario Brothers, but it's not a bad attempt. Graphics were by Manfred Trenz, who is also the brains behind the Turrican series. So, you know, nice. We're not just talking about any chump producer here, and of course Chris Hulsbeck did the music for some Turrican stuff as well. There is some considerable pedigree at work on this one. That's a great tune. I love the massive, crunchy snare sound on that one. You know, I love a good snare, so I'm always going to have time for this.
I've also had like some conversations about this topic fairly recently, because I was added to a retro game group.
About snare drums?
No, yeah, no, not snare too. Drums. Yeah.
Are you part of the snare drum Facebook group?
I am now. I'm going to start it. No, but like, I'm not going to name the group itself, because I don't want to be that. I don't want them bringing their wrath on me or whatever. But there's a sort of a level of, I want to say, egotism that goes on there. It's like, you know, they spend all their time kind of like henpicking games and whatever.
Okay.
And the topic of knockoffs or ripoffs came up. And my philosophy for those is, simply put, if I like a game and the game itself plays well, and some other guy goes, I also like that game, I want to take a crack at it and make slight variations so I can't get sued. And they release that product. If it's fun, who cares? Like, right. You look at Zelda, there's Newtopia, there's like Crusader Senti. Some might would call that a ripoff, but I don't think it is, but some would. Landstalker. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of games that said, hey, this Zelda game exists, but we want to do something like it, but not. And a lot of them turn out to be pretty freaking awesome games in their own right. And I personally can't see any fault in playing such titles and enjoying them.
Yeah, I remember being really into Mario Kart on the Super Nintendo at my friend's house, and like wanting to have that experience at home, but I only had the Sega Genesis and no money. So at one point I got like this shareware version of like this kart racing game, and I just played it to death. It was Mario Kart.
Yeah.
But like there was a time like in the early 90s where it was just clone after clone after clone of Mario Kart coming out on computer systems. Like on the old Windows and DOS systems, and it was just I didn't care. As long as I was a penguin, it was Mario. It didn't matter to me.
See, I didn't even know that, because on consoles, we started getting that kind of style too. Like, there was like Crash Team Racing, which was its own take,
classic,
but on Sony systems.
Classic game, that one.
We had, what was it, Konami Crazy Racers, which was Konami's take on Mario Kart. Sega eventually came out with theirs, Sonic All-Stars Racing.
Yeah, yeah. They should have made a Street Fighter racer. That would have been cool.
Yeah, we probably know it's probably out there somewhere. We just got to start looking.
Ever tried Chocobo Racing? You remember that one?
Yeah, Chocobo Racing, yeah. Same logic, which is all the square characters. Like, I think Torneko was a freaking unlockable in that game. And like various like Final Fantasy classes. Yeah. But people would sit there and go, oh, that's a ripoff. Bro, just play Mario Kart. I'm like, how about I just play a game that's played by, made by a guy who thinks Mario Kart's a cool system, but they want Chocobos instead of Mario's.
Variety's the spice of life, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I like that we're all like-minded folks on this grouping here. We can have these kinds of discussions.
I'm still judging
you.
Silently.
No purist whatsoever.
No, of course not.
So, what do you have for us next, Rob?
Okay, I am also going to play a C64 track, and I wanted to find another heavy metal-sounding game, so I chose from Hammer Fist. We got our fists up.
Everyone fists in the air for this one.
Which is
I'll hold my teacup. That's close enough.
Which is a really rad-looking side-scrolling beat-em-up for the Commodore 64. And this is the loader. Another loader? No, this is track three.
Track three
for Hammer Fist by Wally Beben.
Hammer Fist on the C64. Wally Beben on that track. Fast arpeggios, constantly roaring through the night. It's pretty intense, no?
Yeah, totally. I picked this one because it reminded me of some Neil Baldwin tunes on the NES, where there's like arpeggiations on top of arpeggiations, just like, and like that's your tune, you know? Like, they'll put like, it's like one or two chords, and then it'll have a couple leads on top of that. And it's real simple, but I think it's really effective on the hardware that it's going. I mean, obviously, there's pretty impressive stuff on the C64 nowadays, but I love that sound. It's just so heavy and crunchy and annoying in a good way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I think it's meant to kind of make you a little unsettled, perhaps, especially given that this game's... to get anywhere on this game is no mean feat, from what I can tell. It's pretty tricky. I haven't really managed to get beyond the second screen. For shame. But I'm working on it, you know. So let's get into this game. It's you control a couple of characters who you can kind of change between, and one of them is the eponymous Hammer Fist, and the other one is like a female counterpart called Metallicis, or Metal Isis. Metallicis, I'll go with that.
Yeah, that sounds much better than Metal Isis.
Just like gymnastic flips and such.
That's right, yeah, it's like a platforming mechanic.
You know what it reminds me of, kind of, too? Did you used to watch Nick Arcade back? They did it air over there.
I don't think we got that, to be honest.
Oh, man. Like, it was a Nickelodeon show where kids would play video games for, of course, prizes. And the final round, the stick was, we put you in the game! But it was actually just a green screen, and kids would stumble and fumble as they tried to make sense of what they were doing.
Okay.
But the games, the rooms that they would make them enter and interact with, highly resemble what this game looks like to me. Because it would just be like a flat room, and there would be things in the room they had to interact with. Like, okay, go pull the switch! Now go break the screen, or whatever. And that's exactly what this game plays like to me. Like, you're walking around in one like a still room, and there's a bunch of stuff you can interact with, and they're like, break the monitors or pull the lever to eventually unlock the door to go to the next room.
That's
so
it.
It's kind of starting to make me wonder if this may have been the style of game or the exact game they were looking at when they designed the rooms for Nick Arcade.
I don't know.
It's possible.
The pixel artwork is really impressive for what it is, especially like some of the enemies that I saw. It was really cool.
It's pretty sharp, yeah. It's quite a sophisticated game, truth be told. Difficult, but sophisticated. And like, I can't help but find it really funny because, as you say, you do have to break some of the screens and things to advance. And the manner in which you break the screens is by doing this really exaggerated headbutt against the wall. Like, you're just, like, smashing your head against the wall, breaking all these computers. So if kids were doing that on TV, then I don't know, man.
That's maybe awesome. Should have been Hammerhead.
Hammerhead,
fist.
Yeah. Not since Kabuki Quantum Fighter has there been awesome headbanging.
Good old Bonk.
Or Bonk. Oh, right, Bonk. Duh.
Yeah, that's a great tune, though.
Yeah, really cool. Thanks.
Like, when we're done recording this episode, you definitely should go look up the Nick Arcade screen just to get the chuckle out of it. Because
so bad.
These kids were just god-awful at this. It made me wonder what exactly they had them looking at on the green screen room.
I can't
play
imagine.
So poorly.
I can't imagine what the taping of those shows was like.
The host was like, I need a drink. This is too
totally.
Much.
It's pretty bad.
What are those two golden rules in show business? You never work with children or animals.
Yeah. I guess if you're going to go work for a children's television channel, you know, you're going to be dealing with both, and you better get used to it real fast.
All right, I've got another pick for you, and this is an Atari 8-bit family pick. So the Atari 8-bit family consists of many systems, including the XL series and XE series. I had one back in the day when I was a kid, and it broke, sadly. It had an XEGS, which was the kind of game system counterpart to the home computer line. And the system's got a very particular sound to it. It's got a chip called the Pokey, P-O-K-E-Y.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That is officially the best chip name I've ever heard. I have to say that.
Pokey. So I did an episode on the Pokey a couple of months ago, I want to say. And, like, doesn't seem to be as many titles for this family of computers as the C64, but nevertheless, there are still some really good examples of VGM coming out of this machine. And I found another one, and the game is called Gunhead. And we're going to have the title track from Gunhead, composed by Radek Sturber. we just had Gunhead on the Atari 8-bit family of computers, composed by Radek Sturber. So, you know, I like to bring the funk wherever possible, and hopefully I've managed that to some degree with this pick. So the Porky's got like a really raspy sound that in the wrong hands might sound a bit cheap, but in the right hands, i.e. these hands, it's a really beautiful thing. Like, I love the kind of bouncing effect in the refrain, you know, like a do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, that sort of thing. It's a pretty, like, imaginative rhythmic feature, that, you know?
Yeah. Have you ever heard of Aphex Twin? Had that one track, Bucephalus's bouncing ball. He has a metal ball and he drops it, and it's just dropping, and as it hits the ground, it gets faster, like and he makes a whole rhythm track out of that. It really reminded me of that kind of effect.
Yeah, it's nice, man. It's sort of it suggests a certain kind of precarious energy, right? Especially in a game as tense as this. You know, this is kind of a Metroid-esque affair, like a Metroidvania almost, certainly operating somewhere close to the limit of what the Atari 8-bit hardware is capable of.
Yeah, the only Atari system I had was the 2600, and then I used to collect games in high school, and I had the 52 and the 78.
Right.
And that was my only exposure to it, and I didn't have many 7800 games, because I don't think there were that many made, but...
I don't think so, no. Yeah, Atari kind of fell off after the 2600 to some degree, although they did keep producing machine after machine hanging in there, right?
You said that the game plays like a Metroidvania-style game?
Yeah, I haven't played it myself, but from what I understand, it sort of looks one heck of a lot like a Metroid kind of affair.
Because this is messing with me, because I looked up Gunhead, and I've come across... Yeah, this is definitely a different game, but it's called Gunhead. I've seen it with spelled H-E-D and H-E-A-D, and it resembles a vertical shooter that also highly resembles a shooter that I liked a lot on the TurboGrafx-16 called Cybercore, where like you get like different ships that transform into bugs, and the weapons resemble like or based off like the bug ship you get, and all the bosses are insect-like. So I actually need to look this game up later, because I'm curious about it, because if it's a Metroidvania style game, I'm interested. If it's this weird shooter game, I'm also interested.
Yeah.
I just want to play Gunhead.
Oh, here it is.
Either way. Here we go. Rob just found Gunhead. He brought up this. Oh, wow. How does it, it's the exact same name too, but
yeah, it's kind of wild,
so
right?
Different. Yeah, but I want to play them both.
Yeah, this Metroidvania-esque take on Gunhead, I believe it was released in 1994, so sometime after the hardware's real commercial life, and maybe hence why it looks so decent as well.
Yeah, it does look really, really good, but I like a lot of these like kind of side-scrolling beat-em-ups and styles on these old 8-bit computers. The movement is really slow, and so I would imagine there's probably a lot of lag between you inputting a button and then like the animation of an arm moving forward or something like that. You're probably fighting with the game, and that creates the difficulty.
Yeah, possibly.
Oh man,
and that has me wondering too, because I never even thought about that. So you brought up that mentioning of how the movement is, how slow the characters are. So like there were games back in the day that people like the Out of This World and Prince of Persia.
Oh, yeah.
Those styles of video. Also, I think Abe's Odyssey had that similar style too.
Yeah, very similar. I love Abe's Exodus.
But the thing that bugged me about those games, as much as I loved the concepts, was how stiff the character movement was.
Right.
I didn't realize that was maybe a design choice based on the hardware's limitations.
I think so, because like I think what they were going for was probably like the smoothest amount of animation frames that they could do on the hardware to best mimic like how a person would move, like their legs and their jumping and the kinetics of everything. But when you do that, you end up with like having like, you know, 15, almost 20 frames of lag from when you input going left. But like when you're playing a video game, like who wants that? Like who wants realism to that scale?
It's not that satisfying, is it?
No, and it comes off clumsy, which is why I think Abe's Exodus works, because he's supposed to be kind of clumsy. And when you die over and over again, it just gets funnier and funnier. Yeah.
So it wasn't as punishing.
Oh, it's punishing, but it's worth it. I think so, anyway.
Yeah, you enjoy the punishment on this occasion.
On the track that you played, it had like a you called it like a grating kind of sound. I had like a metallic, but it was like rhythmic in the background.
Right.
Is that Is that on a lot of the Atari 8-bit family?
Most definitely, yeah. There's one really curious thing about the system is that it's not really equally tempered in terms of the distances between the pitch in the same way that, like, we're used to hearing. So sometimes melodies can sound really out of tune. So what a lot of composers did was they combined voices to make it sound like it's more in tune than the hardware actually is. And that might result in some weird internally dissonant timbres, you know? It is a really raspy system.
Even the composers were fighting against the hardware. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a case of taking a kind of deficiency and turning it into something creative, you know? I mean, there's a long history of composers doing that.
You gotta love the fact that they go through all these issues to fight with the hardware, as you say, and they still churn out such awesome product.
Yeah. Right.
It makes the victory extra sweet.
Yeah, that was a really, really cool tune.
Yeah. We're moving on to Purnell again.
Yep.
I like when it's Purnell. I can't quite explain the why.
I like when it's Purnell.
Do. Well, my final track is also from a game that I am loosely familiar with through reading about it immensely in Nintendo Power, but never played it myself because I couldn't afford the game back then.
Oh, no.
But I'm going to play it eventually. I want to because I've played games like it. The game is called Lemmings, and the track is called Smile If You Love Lemmings from the Commodore 64. So, hope you digs it.
Let's do it. You love Lemmings, and we're all smiling because we all love Lemmings. And that that was from Lemmings, oddly enough, a C64 version composed by Gerwin Tell. Very bouncy, very cheerful. Although, I mean, it's a great tune, but it might jar a little bit if you make a mistake and cause 30-odd Lemmings to fall to their horrible deaths. But then again, I suppose that was always a part of the game's charm to have that vaguely gruesome thing happening and... The game's quite lighthearted on the whole. Really, really quirky title, this one.
Yeah, very, very quirky. This came out... When this came out, I remember it was so different, and I remember everybody was playing it. And it was really heavily driven by using a mouse. Playing this without a mouse was really difficult.
But you had to on the C64. I had to use a joystick to move the cursor.
Oh, man.
I mean, I've played this on my own trusty C64, and I can't help but be amazed at how they made it work. Like, it's really impressive, actually.
Yeah, the console games did the exact same variation. It was like, because it was a Genesis version and a Super Nintendo version of this game. Same logic, like, I guess you had to use like the cross pad and like the triggers to kind of scroll between the powers. Like, get your builder up there, make the bridge. But since you had to, you couldn't just like speed select it, you were prone to make a number of blunders, which was unfortunate. But one thing about this that makes me smile, and it came up in another chat that came not too long ago, where, you know, people like to always discuss, you know, game music that they like, games that they just don't like. Like, wait, what systems have music you just don't like? And people like to reference like old computer systems, like, oh, the music of those things were just terrible, blah, blah, blah. And for me, I can't think of a system, computer or console, that has just blatantly bad music. I can't just say everything on this machine sounds terrible. Like, yeah, no. Yeah. It's always, there's something about every system that sounds good. It's just a matter of finding that tune. Hmm. And I listened to like the console Lemmings tracks, and I like this better, actually,
oh, really?
Than the console versions. Yeah, by far. It just sounds better. Like, things that some might say make it not stand out, to me, is what makes it stand out and makes it sound that much more unique and interesting to check out. Mm. So, I love this tune, and I love the idea of Lemmings. The only games I got to play that were like it, unfortunately, was you ever heard a game back called Krusty's Super Funhouse?
Yeah, that was...
Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah, there were no powers, so to speak, but you had the lemming-type characters being the rats, just kind of moving, and you had to lure them to the rat traps, so you were still doing, like, build this here, make this spin, do this to get them to go. And I loved that more than anything. I was obsessed with it.
Yeah, that was a great game, and it had a little bit of PCM sampling where Krusty did this very sinister, "Hi, kids!" Like, Sega Mega Drive, you know, crunchiness. Hell of a game.
Maybe it was right around when Lemmings came out, but it must have been, like, late 80s. Had to have been late 80s. I had a 2400 baud modem attached to my old Tandy computer system. So, like, in the States, we had a Radio Shack.
Right,
there's little electronic stores, and they'd sold the Tandy PCs. And so I would connect to a local bulletin board system called the PC Pub, and they had like a whole file directory, and I would find like Lemmings and a whole bunch of other like weird like stuff that God knows what it is anymore. But I would set it to download, and then I'd have to wait hours and hours and hours for it to come down, and just pray that like no one would pick up the phone and like screw it up. And then I'd have the game, and it was still like just the demo. It was like the first like two stages or three stages, and I would just play it over and over again on my old like CGA screen. So everything was pink and blue, and then like, because it was such an old computer, like it would run out of hard drive space, and I'd have to delete it. And if I wanted to play it again, I'd have to like download it again.
Oh, the bad old days.
Oh my gosh.
Did you then go to school and tell the kids that you were like the best player at Lemmings ever because you beat every stage the game had over and over again?
I feel like in those days, like no one knew, like people with modems and going on to this stuff. I didn't know anybody else who had any of that kind of thing or was interested in doing that at all. But it was awesome because when Doom first was released, we were able to get a hold of it through the bulletin board systems that they were affiliated with. And being like first to be on board with that was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, especially given how far along it went, so that when the game became popular, you were like, let me show you how this is done. Step aside, buddy. You know.
Yeah, actually, my best friend growing up, yeah, he grew up on a farm that's pretty close to here, and his uncle was running the bulletin board systems out of the barn. So I would go over there, and we'd play like laser tag and stuff in the orchard. And then up at the top of the barn, he had like racks and racks of like servers and stuff where he was running the bulletin board system. It was just so incongruous of like this working farm and then like, you know, what is at the time state of the art like computer hardware.
Yeah That's where it was all coming from, those farms.
Yeah, it must have been. Yeah It's like weird rural America wanting to get into playing Lemmings.
it's good a place as any to start, no doubt.
Yeah, but this game brought back all those memories. Listen to that music, it really did.
That's one thing I definitely love about game music. It's perfect for heaps of nostalgia. Sometimes it doesn't even have anything to do with the game you're playing. It's just like, I remember the best time when I had the best candy from the best farm. You know, like, it doesn't even matter. It's just, nostalgia is a beast.
I guess for myself, it's a case of borrowed nostalgia a lot of the time, because I didn't really have any access to the internet until I was probably about 11, 12 years old. And, I mean, prior to the internet being really a mainstream thing here in the UK, the demo scene had its means of doing a similar bulletin board type thing, like sending messages back and forth and sharing, like, well, cracks and different demo scene productions and things like that. And with getting my C64 up and running now and with my SD reader, I'm downloading lots of these old demos where they're sending messages to each other. And the music on these demos, it's absolutely astonishing sometimes. Mm. You know, it's like, how on earth did you manage to do this across three channels on a SID chip? And it's a bit like a personal archaeology project in a sense.
Oh, yeah.
So I mean, it's not nostalgia, but it's kind of borrowed. Ah, oh, man, if only I were 10 years older, I could have been there doing it or something like that, you know?
I can relate to that 100%, to be perfectly honest with you. And in the case of, like, through knowing, like, Rob is the one who told me about this demo scene. And, of course, when you learn about it from someone late in the game, you've already passed the moment where it was all fresh and new and crazy. So it doesn't hold the same weight for me, but I'm like, man, I wish I was around when people were first doing this and interested, because I could be right in the center of it. Or like that band you liked that you come up, like, you listen to Spotify and this band pops up in your mix. You're like, oh, they're awesome. Wonder what they're doing now. They disbanded 10 years ago. Well, that's just wonderful.
Yeah.
I can't feel the hype anymore.
All right. Let's have another pick from Rob. This is your third pick.
Yes. So I went outside of the 8-bit zone just because I really wanted to play this tune. And you were like, yeah, sure, go ahead. We can go a little bit more into the 16-bit style.
I'm doing the same.
Oh, great. So this is the from the Amiga. This is the intro theme to Test Drive 2 by Chris Hatfield. And I love this song. I never really got into Test Drive 2, but when I was looking for tunes of this style at one point, and then I ran into this, and I just fell in love with this song. So it's intro to Test Drive 2.
All right. we just had the intro from Test Drive 2 on the Commodore Amiga, composed by Chris Hadfield. And right off the bat, I've got to say, that's a pretty amazing bass line, very 80s in its way.
Yeah.
And, you know, that lead melody absolutely screams Amiga. That's what Amiga is, as far as I'm concerned, that lead voice.
Amiga that awesome, does. Like, flute, keyboard flute, like, 90s keyboard flute, like, from a Yamaha, like, keyboard. I love it. I love that sound.
Yeah, great sample. And there are some really curious embellishments on the drums at the ends of certain bars as well, like these quite nice little cadential rolls. So there's some, a lot of thoughts got into this, I think.
Yeah, the there's those drum fills, which never go past like 16th notes, are all, they really scream like 90s or 80s, like Duran Duran or that kind of like classic sound.
Right. Depeche Mode, maybe.
Yeah, Depeche Mode. Yeah, that's what I was looking for. And but yeah, and that whole song's bass line. Like, that bass line with that drum set, oh, it's just killer. It takes me into, like, driving with the top down, like in California, I'd imagine, how that feels. I have no idea.
Well, that's... I mean, it's interesting that you make that comment, because I think that's pretty much the vibe the game was going for, yeah, too. Because I didn't even realize it until you brought this up and I looked it up. My older brother used to have this game, so I have played it before.
Oh, really?
I just didn't realize it. The thing that made me click with it was the fact that this game, you would get bugs on your windshield while you drove.
Yeah, every once in a while.
So, yeah, it's pretty much because there was no... I don't recall there even being a real opponent in the race. You were just driving from point A to point B on the highway.
And every once in a while, a cop would try to pull you over.
Yeah. That I could see Depeche Mode going pretty well with that sort of environment.
Just like, no doubt. Yeah, I can see it. It's funny, so here's another game, like Twin Turbo V8 from the top of the show, where you take the wheel of a red Ferrari, and not only a red Ferrari, but my childhood favourite sports car, the Ferrari F40, so I'm completely on board with Test Drive 2. You know, I'm hardly a massive nut for cars, but that's still probably my dream car. And, you know, this game's actually quite a neat little driving sim where you have to, as you say, you got to duck the police at certain points, but you're just dodging other cars and not crashing. But what I particularly like is if you don't go quick enough, the game taunts you with messages like, drive faster, it's only a game.
That's right.
So I'm reading these messages, and my reckless driving is only rewarded with like a shattered windscreen, because you can drive into, if you swerve to avoid cars or try and stay on the track, you can like hit a cactus. And I mean, it turns out a cactus can do a lot of damage. Like, I'm crashing into these cacti and it completely like wrecks my windscreen, wrecks my car. So I mean, it's kind of surprising that a cactus would stop a speeding Ferrari, but
you know, I don't know, we don't have any cactus cacti on our side of the coast, so maybe it is a danger, maybe it's a real problem,
maybe they're metallic. Yeah. Maybe they evolved into metallic cactuses to deal with the harsh climate.
Could be it. Yeah, that's evolution for you right there.
Oh, yeah.
No, I think the evolution's cactuar.
they launched their needles at passing cars.
Yeah. That's a great tune, though. Thanks a lot for picking that. Chris Hadfield, he's got lots of credits, including he did the sound for NBA Showdown 1993 for the SNES. I don't imagine you're particularly surprised that I've sniffed that little fact out, because I picked a tune from that game for my recent-ish NBA episode. So any listeners into NBA licensed games, I covered quite a few of them, although hardly all of them. There are so many out there. But yeah, Chris Hadfield did some sound on NBA Showdown 93.
Was that an EA title?
Yeah, I believe it was. Yeah. EA throughout the 90s had some kind of near monopoly on official licensed sports games, didn't they?
Yeah, they totally did. I remember when the Dreamcast came out and those Sega sports games that came out, and they were really good, but like it was so interesting that there was suddenly a rival to Electronic Arts.
All right, well, I believe we're down to one last track, and that would be mine. But before I get into this, just want to say a really, really, really big thank you to both of you, Rob and Purnell, for making this show possible. You've basically been running the tech for this one, doing most of the recording on your end, because I'm a little bit of a klutz when it comes to remote broadcasting and all that. So thanks for making this possible, and for your excellent picks, keeping me company on a Sunday night.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed this date that we've had, and I hope we can do this again sometime.
I'm always about hanging out, doing music talks, and hanging out, just discussing good jams.
Yeah.
Heaven forbid we happen to have some similar game systems to play. I'd play games with you, too. I'm indifferent, man.
Ooh, that's the dream. Maybe one day we can make that possible. Get myself over there and we'll do it for real.
Oh, man. Yeah, if you could bring yourself over here to hang out, that would be legit.
Or if we can get over there, that would be awesome. I've only been over like a couple times, but just in the London area. So I'd love to see more of the country.
Oh, come to the north.
Yeah, the real north.
Yeah, well, you're always welcome up here, you know, both of you. Right. Maybe we can do some kind of battle type thing, VGM battle type thing, either in person or remotely. We can talk about this. It would be great to have you on board and give you a chance at winning the prestigious Forever Sound Version trophy.
What's the downside is if we did win it, what would happen? Because we want to take it home, of course. We can't just leave it there.
I could always retire the trophy and get another one.
we can run the game. Like, if we take this win, it's done.
Yeah, it's a Stanley Cup. It just comes with us for a while, and then we have to mail it back. It gets on to the next person.
Yeah, so would you fellas like to do some plugs? I mean, obviously Rhythm and Pixels, right?
Oh, for sure.
Oh, yeah. So go check out rhythmandpixels.com, and you can check it out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, everywhere. Rhythm and Pixels, all one word. You can also find us on all the podcast applications for your personal devices. My English is terrible today. Fernell, you can take over.
The words of the languages.
Keep those words coming, my friend.
But yeah, we've been doing this for like, I guess,
almost 2 years.
Almost 2 years now. Yeah, wow. We're coming really close to our 2 year podcast anniversary, which we got to do something special for. But yeah, I love doing it, and love getting together every week. Just another excuse to hang out and you know, listen to game music.
Hear, hear to that. And in the event that you heard some jams, you love the jams, but you want to see one of the hosts get really angry, and every once in a blue moon, Rob too. Well, who am I kidding? Rob doesn't get angry. He just makes me angrier on this show.
Yeah.
Check out Pernell and Matt Play Games on YouTube, where we get together every once in a while, and we choose the original theme was, you know, take a game that you remember being hard as a child, play it as a grown man with responsibilities and obligations, and see if the difficulty measures up. It results in some fun times, some angry times, but always, always a good time. So check that out if you're interested in it. And other than that, just hope you like the show. Hope you like Forever Sound Version, because for the record, this show, Forever Sound Version, is genuinely on point. It's got heart to spare.
Yeah.
And it's got quality tunes.
Oh, it's much appreciated.
Oh, man, this is from the heart. It's legit. Like, you come up with awesome quality choices. You speak with honest knowledge of what you're bringing up. You're no poser. You are awesome. And I think more people need to be checking you out.
Yeah, you are a must listen. Every time it's on, it's a must listen.
Oh, likewise, man. I mean, I've been listening to Rhythm and Pixels for quite some time, and I'm just astonished at how you keep on doing this week upon week, and I don't know, just the enthusiasm for the music shines through each and every time. And
oh, good,
man, it's just every Monday morning's a treat. For as long as this show is going on, I'm never gonna have a bad Monday morning, and that's a real blessing. So thanks a lot for keeping that going and for sharing all that music with us.
Good. It's our pleasure every time. Thank you very much for having us on your show.
No doubt.
And every time you guest on our show, you give us a topic selection, which takes the weight off our shoulders. Because I'm not going to lie, that's, to me, is the hardest aspect of the show. It's not picking music. It's not getting together. It's just coming up with topics. There's so much music, but only so many topics to go around. We have a bit of a challenge over here where it's like, how long do we go until we have to double dip on a topic?
Yeah.
And every once in a while we have, yeah, totally. But there's usually a good excuse, like the wild card doesn't count, because it's like, well, we just haven't had time to choose a topic because life got in the way. Or we recently had a Phoenix Wright episode double dip, but that's because the guest suggested it. So yeah, we go with the guest's desire, you know, but we fight the urge.
Keep on keeping on, man. Have you done a football game, like a soccer game episode yet?
We've had a couple sports episodes or sports themed episodes.
We did sports and we did golf.
Yeah.
Oh, golf.
So
that
we
was
could
classic,
narrow down. We could drill down.
We can go straight to football. There's a lot of football games out there.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Now I'll crack my knuckles for some football selections.
All right. Okay. I'll hold you to that. All right. So if you'd like to get in touch with me, you can email me at foreversoundversion@gmail.com. You can like this podcast on Facebook at facebook.com/foreversoundversion. And you can follow me on Twitter. The handle is FSVpodcast. So, you know, by all means, get in touch. It's always nice to hear what you make of the show and that you're enjoying the tunes. So we're going to have one more pick, and it is mine, and it's a Commodore Amiga track. And once again, it's a game that is kind of on the verge of what you might call a Metroidvania these days. And it's an excellent game from Gremlin, who are a very important British software house. If you like vibrant 16-bit pixel art, then you'll find plenty to enjoy with this one. The game is Switchblade 2, and the composer is Barry Leach, who, as I'm sure you know, has many a credit. He's got some goods. This is a track comprised of lots of rich samples and tense, skittering patterns. Classic Barry Leach kind of material. It's a bit of a dark and heavy one to close the show with, but hopefully you'll be into it. This is the title track from Switchblade 2. Thanks once more, fellas. It's been a good time, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your Sunday evening over there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, all the best for now.